Are you relaxed like that?
Yeah, I'm very relaxed.
So relaxed, can you not tell?
I'm almost asleep.
Welcome back to another edition of After the Whistle. I am delighted to say I've got one of my old playing colleagues, Danny Grucock, MBE, sat with me today. The enforcer, as we used to know. You all right, mate? How are you going?
Oh, very good. Thank you, Lewis. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. The enforcer's days are now sort of long behind you. Give me a little rundown of what you're up to now and where you're at.
So now I'm working for Clifton College, helping their rugby program. We've got a very strong rugby program, working with Matt Salter.
Matt Salter?
Yes.
He was my roommate in my first ever England experience, so under 18s. You say Matt Salter, I reacted like that because I've not heard that name in years, but he was my first roommate as a under 18. So I was 16 years old, went to the England under 18 camp, knew no one, absolutely terrified. Matt was my roommate, and he was actually a lovely chap.
You and him are the same age?
No, he's significantly older than me.
But he looks significantly older.
He's, yeah. So he'd be 43 or something. Anyway, diverted, but go on. So Matt's?
Yeah. So Matt's director of rugby. I'm the quite poshly titled high performance manager. And then I also work with Bristol Academy. So working with the under 16s and under 18s.
Mate, so look, I want to run through your CV because you had an awesome career. You obviously started up in Cov. So you were born in 72, up in Coventry, another Cov skin. So you went to school, obviously you come from a great stock at Barker's Butt. You then played for Coventry from 94 to 97. Memories of that?
I think I didn't dream of ever playing for the city. You know, that was sort of, I generally thought that was going to be the best I'd ever get when I got that chance.
Yeah.
So I just sort of played for Barker Butts, ended up playing with the first team there, played in Midlands Division 1, which, you know, again, was a big thing for me. And then we went on, I got picked for the Warwickshire 21s as my first representative rugby. We went on tour. So these were kind of real sort of significant parts of my career because it really motivated me to train hard. And then from that, I simply just got better opportunities.
Why did that particular time motivate you to train hard? Was there anything? Was it just the love of the game? Was there something in particular that?
I think it was the love of the game, but then, you know, I enjoyed playing rugby. I enjoyed recognising that I could get better. So I wasn't overly skillful. It may surprise you.
But
I realised actually if I did certain things, I could actually get slightly better. And it is those small incremental goals that do sort of push you on. And actually, the fact I couldn't pass off my left hand was a surprise to most people. But then suddenly I put some time to it, got a bit better, and I sort of really took to it. And then I sort of got, just simply other opportunities came up. So the tour was quite significant because it was something I didn't think I'd get on.
Which tour?
The tour to Zimbabwe.
Okay, Warwickshire
21s.
Oh, okay, the tour, obviously the big one.
And it was, you know, we were sort of given the summer to kind of train to get ready for it, and there's going to be fitness tests then this team was selected accordingly. And I just didn't think I'd be good enough to go. I was at university, but my parents sort of gave me the summer to train. So I probably trained like a professional at that time just to get ready for the tour.
How old were you then?
I was 21. I just trained flat out and then got fitter, did lots of extra training, skill sessions, got better, got picked on the tour. And then I came back and then Coventry asked if I'd, play for them. So my final year at university, I was playing for Coventry and I helped them get relegated my first year.
Which was Congratulations.
A significant achievement. One of the greatest clubs in the country, and I dragged them down.
So anyway, so you got your chance. You ended up going to Coventry. Was it three or four years there? Then I remember, so I was coming through in 96 at Leicester, 97, 98. They were starting to, obviously, that transition into the professional era. I remember there being a lot of chat about you being on Leicester's hit list at the time. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, so I went to meet Bob Dwyer a couple of times. I'd had a good few years at Coventry, and Coventry had kind of had a bit of investment, and they had lots of guys from Bristol, Derek Eves, Andy Blackmore, some great Bristol players came up to play for Coventry. Derek Eves was player coach. At the same time, we had sort of Jez Harris, Wayne Kilford, these guys from Leicester came in, and then mixed in with some sort of Coventry local lads.
Were they on loan then? No.
They came up, played for Coventry. They saw the light. Saw the great
big club. Big money transfer.
big money transfer to Coventry, and we actually had a really good dynamic with that real experience from Leicester and Bristol, and a fairly young but robust group of lads from Coventry, and I was one of that group from Coventry, and we actually had a couple of. Despite getting relegated in the first year, we sort of won the third division the following year, and then we competed in the second division with, at that time, probably the most professional clubs, and that was Richmond and Newcastle.
So second division, that would be the Championship now,
So, you know, we had Richmond and Newcastle had all the top internationals playing. You know, they had Scott Quinnell, I think Gibbs played. There was a whole stack of players. All competing in
they're both the Quinnell brothers, aren't they?
Pichot, and
Andrew Leeds, do you remember him? Fullback from Australia.
No.
Okay, brilliant. Okay.
But that was a really, really competitive time for me. And I had some good role models around me, some really strong characters. And then it meant at the end of that year, I actually got picked on the 97 Lions tour. All the England players went to South Africa.
Yeah.
And then England toured at the same time, went to Argentina. And the next kind of batch of second rows were all injured. So Gareth Archer, Richard West, Dave Sims, they were all injured. And there literally wasn't a second row in the first division, or the Premiership as it is now. And then they looked into the second division and then literally pulled my name out of the hat. So I then went on tour as a second division player.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I got capped when I was still at Coventry, but that obviously raised my profile. And then other clubs were interested. So Leicester came and spoke to me. Saracens came and spoke to me.
So then, why did you end up, so obviously you then ended up going to Saracens. Was there, I mean, you've got, at the time we would have had Martin Johnson at Leicester, Matt Paul, Ben Kay might have just been, no, Fritz van Heerden. What was the pull to Saracens over Leicester?
I think they showed a bit more enthusiasm. I was concerned, really? I recognised the strength of the kind of Leicester lineup, and I thought I was just going to be a squad player there. I wasn't necessarily going to play games. And Saracens seemed to have a bit more confidence in my ability at the time. They probably didn't know me, and they're probably kidding, lying to me, and I believed them.
Good sales technique. Yeah, Nigel Ray wasn't offering you like £1 million house or anything like that.
No.
Investment into a job on the side.
Also, I was so shocked by that. I thought, I was there 4 years, no one offered me anything. But they had some brilliant players at Saracens as well. And I had a fantastic second row partner, Paddy Johns. So when I looked at it, I thought, actually, I might play some games here at Saracens. And yeah, it was the start of four fantastic years in the Premiership and with Saracens.
So who would have been there as well? So it was Pienaar, Francois Pienaar.
Yeah, it was the team I
Richard Hill
went into. It was an unbelievable team.
Yeah.
So Michael Leiner, at that time the highest international points scorer. Philippe Sello at that time the most capped international, 111 caps. And he never played in the Six Nations, he played in the Five Nations. So I still can't get my head around how he got 111 caps.
That's amazing. That is an amazing stat.
Yeah,
you're right.
Yeah. Yeah, Richard Hill, Paul Wallace, come back off the Lions tour, Kieran Bracken, you know, it was, and obviously Paddy Johns, my second row partner, you know, Francois Pienaar was captain, Tony Diprose. So again, it was a kind of, almost like an international kind of Barbarians team, some top young English players and me. And I was sort of, oh wow, this is, it's not a bad team to be in.
So you had that time at Saracens. You were there for 97 to 2001. You played 63 games. But you then went on to play for Bath from 2001 to 2011. 160 games. Is that right?
220.
I thought it was more than that, because I was there when you got your 200 game.
Don't believe everything you read on Wikipedia.
220 games. So you were captain of Bath for two seasons?
No, just the one, I think.
Just
one's
one.
Enough, yeah.
Was that during your... So you had a relegation battle one season?
That might have been me.
Was it?
Yeah.
But an incredible job to stay up, because I can't remember who went down that year. But probably, having never been in a position like that myself, but having seen Leicester last year and spoken to Jordan and the stress that can create, actually staying up can be like winning the trophy.
Without doubt. And that's why I do reflect on it with such strong bonds with these guys. And I think it is that shared sense of adversity which actually pulls people together. And you know, I've no doubt the England team now, you know, they've had a brilliant semi-final and they'll be devastated with the result come the final. But I think the exciting thing is the vast majority of that team will be available in 4 years' time, and I'm pretty sure it'll make that team stronger, more resilient, and are quite a frightening team to play against. I think exciting times ahead for that group. But that was it. You know, unfortunately, I had to captain the team when we were in the shtuck.
How did you find that? I mean, I captained England in 2011, and you know, it was a particularly, although it was an amazing moment to be captain of England, we went through a really tough time in that World Cup in 2011, and mentally I found that unbelievably challenging afterwards. You know, the hits that you get from all angles when things go wrong. You know, when everything's going well and you're building nicely, yeah, it's great. When everything goes wrong, you're getting it from mates, teammates, you know, that you work with day in, day out, the media, fans. How did you find that during that time being a captain at Bath?
Yeah, I think, well, there probably wasn't the same social media exposure. And then it made it very easy for me to not read the newspaper.
Okay.
And speak to my mum a lot. So she always had good things to say. She was pretty optimistic about how amazing I was. And
yeah.
You could kind of pick and choose what media you encountered. And I think the challenge for today's player is that they've got social media in their pocket, it's on the table next to them, and there's a million and one people who can comfortably message you and tell you how awful you were. So I just avoided it. You know, if I had a bad day, I didn't need someone else to tell me. I knew myself I had a bad day. I was probably, you know, people talk about being the harshest critic, and I think I was. I recognised what I needed to work on. That's why hopefully I had a sort of long career, and I sort of made some steady improvements. You yourself know, and actually I don't necessarily need the opinions of other people when I've got my own opinion, or this, you know, I've got coaches, I've got my peer group, you know, I've got my players around me. They're the valued opinions who I listen to, and I think that's what you do. You listen to the people you trust.
That's fascinating. I'm also quite interested to listen to you talking about how you know, I was the same towards the latter stages of my career, and that I just didn't want anything to do with the media. Like you said, you know whose opinion you need and whose you trust. But actually, when I was younger, I remember spending a lot of time looking at the papers and, you know, looking for sort of positive affirmation. You know, even if you've had a bad game, you're looking for those, you know, those comments that might give you a little pick-me-up. Actually, did I play as badly as I thought? You know, yeah. How are they going to write it? Did you ever do that as a younger person? Did you ever need to... Do you need sort of affirmation from other people to say that you were doing well?
And I think the older you get, the more experience you gain, you start to recognise whose opinion is important.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, I think I was critical on myself.
Too critical, or looking back now?
I don't think so. I think it's just the environment we're in. You know, we are, and this is what kind of surprised me, going out of that rugby environment into a school environment that, you know, as rugby players, every single day we assess our performance, we are assessed by the coaches, we review that performance and we make adjustments. And it's like a day-to-day, it's what you do every day. And then every Saturday it's exam day and you're tested, you pass the exam some days, you fail the exam some days, and you go through that exam paper with a fine-tooth comb, check through what answers you got right, what answers you got wrong, right? Do some more learning in the week and then back, resit the exam on Saturday. And so that process, I think it's quite a challenging one, but it's a healthy one just to keep you moving, keep you progressing. And I think for rugby players in that professional era, you get your head around that and you embrace that constant challenge you're under. I think it's kind of good for you. So I think, you know, when you've got the media voicing their opinions, it's right, it's making sure you listen to the important ones. You've got enough opinions from your coaches.
Yeah.
And your peer group, I find. And I literally wouldn't read the papers on those particular days. I didn't need their opinion.
And so obviously with the lads that you work with now, you spent a number of years with the Bath Academy, you took on the Bath Academy when you retired, season after you finished, you know, changed, totally transformed that from what it was into a truly professional entity. And then you left. What advice would you give, or do you give your boys now? So obviously you're at Clifton and working with Bristol. What advice do you give the boys related to media and actually that sort of outside influence that can be quite distracting? Because there is so much sort of dumped on them, isn't there?
Yeah. Media is just one of the many distractions that are available to the young player today. And it is finding the bits of media. You've got to embrace media. They'll all embrace social media. It'll all form a valuable part of their lives and actually use it positively. Recognise the bits that they don't need. Recognise the opinions that everyone rightly has. Everyone can say their bit now. But I think with social media, they can just get that little bit closer to the player. So it's recognising, right, that's not actually that important. Everyone can have their say. value the, recognize who the important opinions are, value those, react to those, kind of brush the other ones to one side. And my probably biggest message for the young players today is making sure you've got something away from rugby. So I was always a big fan of the boys continuing their education. Education actually provides that brilliant balance to your life when you're at school. You've got your chemistry lessons, your biology lessons. I'm sure they're a joy for you.
I love those. My favourite, maths, actually.
Maths, again.
I had to take it three times to do it with GCSEs.
Nice. And then you've got your sport. And then so you immediately have a real balance to your life. And the danger sometimes for the modern player, when they finish school, they leave this balanced environment and then they step into a very high-pressured, multi-million pound business with supporters, sponsors and owners with very high expectations on their job and on their performance. And it's making sure that you have a bit of balance to that life that means you can turn off the rugby, focus on something else, whether it be education, could be bricklaying, could be plastering, could be trying to be a mechanic, a gardener, whatever it may be, but gives them that opportunity to physically relax, but mentally switch off. And then you can come back to the training ground, turn the on switch and refocus on the rugby again.
Finding time for downtime is as important as finding time to you know, be training and developing. So before I move on from Bath and chat about England, so you finished your career at Bath as a player, you took on the academy. As I said, you know, in my eyes, did a remarkable job there, transforming it. And you then left Bath. You left the academy job there. Why was that? Did you have a vision to go a different direction, or what was
I think I always enjoyed working with the young players. And towards the last few years of my playing career, I did some work with Bath University and did some work with academy players. So it was a kind of nice transition. And a relatively soft transition. You know, I stayed at the same place of work. Although, in saying that, I was at Lambridge most of my playing career. And then they moved to Farley House.
It was a beautiful training facility at Lambridge, wasn't
two,
it?
Two porta cabins and a field.
and they swamp. Moved to, can you describe it as a field?
Yeah, it was a challenging environment. And they moved to Farley, which is a little bit disappointing. My playing career finished. They moved house and moved training ground.
Do you miss the game? Because I suppose because of your transition, literally you went from playing straight into coaching, you probably didn't have a huge amount of time to reflect.
Yeah, well,
do you miss it?
I missed it in that I didn't enjoy watching games.
Yeah,
in that
Why?
First couple of years, because I probably missed it, and because I was probably one of the few players that managed to finish. I wasn't necessarily in great shape, but I wasn't actually broken.
You were in great shape in terms of as a physical specimen. You were still at 30, what, 30 or 40? How old were you when you died?
38 when I finished. You're too kind less.
And it was remarkable. I think any 21-year-olds at the time would have been happy to be in the same shape as you as 38. Yeah, this is a bit of a bromance, nothing like that. Yeah. It's just admiring your physical specimen.
I'm a married man. But I think I just love training. I loved being out there. It was just a good place to be, and I think I got to the stage where I recognised I didn't want to be a passenger in the team. I always wanted to be a key part of the team. I wanted to be doing my bit, and I got to my last year, and the previous years I'd spoken to the chief exec at that time, Nick Blofeld. I'd kind of got to Christmas, and then he'd kind of pulled me in and said, right, are you good to do one more year? And prior to that, I'd gone, yeah, I feel good. I'll do another year. And we sort of cracked on, and then I got to my final year and got that Christmas, and he's like, right, another year. And I sort of knew myself, I was having to really focus in that year. I'd probably the first time I'd been dropped for the club. So Peter Short, the massive man that he is,
mutant that he is.
he came and took my place, rightly so. I hadn't performed as well as I wanted. I was dropped, he took my place, and so then I was then fighting to get that place back. And I think at that moment it was, right, actually, if I know how many games I've got left to play, I can actually physically, I can concentrate and deliver those performances. If we add another 35 games onto that, that's probably too much for me to focus on. I can't, and I'm not sure if I'm about to do the performances. And I don't want to be the one who's in the squad not playing. I want to be playing. So I knew it was the right decision for me. But then when the games, kick on again, you feel slightly uncomfortable watching those games because you miss it. And I think it does take time for every player. We've been institutionalised to a degree. We've been in that 16 years. That was your routine, training, playing every Saturday, reviewing that performance, and then repeating that time and time again. So at the end of 16 years, that routine suddenly comes to an end. It's a sudden break there. I think it does take you a while to get your head around it, but you know, I love watching the games now. I'm over it now. I'm all right.
So has it been seven, 8 years now?
Yes, my ninth year.
Ninth year. It's funny, isn't it? I love listening to you say, you know, I'm over it now. I'm over it now. But I still get the, well, I know what I'm like. I know I would happily, if I could, and my body was up to it, be back out there. I miss it every day, literally. I miss it every day, the outlet. And that's one question I really want to ask for you, because, you know, I consider myself a physical player. You know, I wasn't a hard player, I wasn't a tough, but I was just competitive. And I just loved the physical aspect of the game. Like, for someone like you, who was an unbelievable competitor to play against and with, how do you replace that? Because, you know, not only the manner in which you played the game, which was ruthless and, you know, full frontal, you know, you also had, as a younger man, black belt in karate or judo. So you clearly loved that physical competitive element. How do you replace that now? Like, how did you replace it immediately after as well?
It was something I didn't sort of realise at the time. Because I think once you sort of get your head around, right, okay, I've got seven more games to play, there is a sense of relief, right, great, I've finished those games, I'm fully reasonably fit, I'm healthy, didn't do any massive injuries, okay, great, time is finished. And then I thought, I'll try and keep fit and healthy, I'll keep going to the gym. And for the next 5 years, I walked past the state-of-the-art, fantastic gym at Farley House, and certainly for the first year, I didn't really go in there. And I thought, for vanity alone, I'll go in and just try and keep fit and try and keep the belly off and things like that. And I just didn't do it. It's probably the realisation about the aspect I missed that realised I need to take on other challenges. Because it was even though the kind of anxiety of Saturday, I'd begin to harness that and understand how it got the best out of me, suddenly we took that away and there was a sense of relief, like, right, okay, I've got through that career, I've done that, I feel good. Sort of 6 months down the line, I realised I actually needed that Saturday anxiety, that challenge, that level of discomfort, which would push me. And that's where, for me, I needed to have my own sort of little personal challenges. And they don't have to be climbing Everest, you know. And my first personal challenge was to run the Bath Half Marathon. And it was something that then forced me to train. It gave me that match day, the Bath Half Marathon. And it was a significant challenge, as was every Premiership game, every international match I played was a significant challenge, a real test. And, you know, I knew I was going to be pushed. And the Bath Half Marathon delivered exactly that for me. It's a long way.
Especially when you're 20-odd stone, not built like a racing snake.
Yeah, so I thankfully I had a training partner, Matt Powell, and we sort of, you know, ran together to try and get ourselves fit. And then come the big day, he literally ran off. I never saw him again. Just disappeared, left me running
slowly.
We're
in it together, bud. See you later.
That was exactly it. He was like, oh, I'll see you at the end then, Matt, thanks. Yeah, and I just sort of trudged on with a simple objective of not stopping. So I just wanted to be able to keep running for the 2:20 took me to do the half marathon. But I was chuffed to bits. You know, that was my personal Everest. That was good.
Nice, personal Everest. I love that. Before we continue, we've just got a brief message from this week's sponsor. It doesn't matter what sport you're into, whether you're a rugby fan, football fan, or anything else, one thing we've all got in common is that we all tend to log on and watch games online if we can't get down to the stadiums in person. Well, ExpressVPN can help you with that. ExpressVPN allows you to access streams from around the world for a fraction of the price that it normally costs. You can use ExpressVPN to buy an 11 sports account, and what's great is it lets you spoof your location. So, for example, if you live in the US and can't always watch the latest matches, you can just spoof your location as you're in the UK and stream away. It comes with apps for computers, mobile and digital media players like Fire TV. And when you go online, it ensures that all your network data is encrypted and safe from hackers. So you've got that added bit of peace of mind. ExpressVPN is the fastest VPN I've tried, costs less than £6 per month and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/moody. That's expressvpn.com/moody. There you go. I even spelled it out for you. For 3 months free with a 1-year package, visit expressvpn.com/moody to learn more. Now let's get back to Gruy. Mate, so we've covered a lot about Bath there. You went on and played for England and the Lions as well. So you had 69 caps for England, including two World Cups, should have been three World Cups. You had a slight run in with, was it James? No, was it Stephen Ferris's arm? He tried to assault one of your boots, I thought, something like that, I think, pre World Cup.
No, there wasn't Stephen Ferris, it was someone else. It might have been someone asked me about it the other day.
Was it Ulster, wasn't it? It was an Ulster.
Yeah, no, that was my last red card.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, that was way later.
There's a topic we're going to get onto, red cards. I mean, obviously we've both had, well, I've only had one. I mean,
I only had a couple more than that.
Yeah, three. I know exactly how many.
Well, let's just say we had the same with international red cards, Lewis, so let's not, you know.
Did you only have one for England?
Only one for England.
Did you really?
Yes, that's right.
That is unbelievable.
Same as you, Lewis.
I couldn't believe that I was the only Englishman. Like, I never had a red card during my career. Yes, I was confrontational and... But I only had one red card in my career. I couldn't believe after that game against Samoa, I found out I was, especially when I played with blokes like you, that, you know, ruthless, tough blokes, to find out I was the first person to get sent off at Twickenham as an Englishman. I definitely wasn't proud. There was maybe an element of pride. But but so you did, you had 6-9 caps, you know, World Cups. Obviously, you played in 03. And you had a couple of injuries during that, which must have been frustrating. You had your two Lions tours in 01 and 05. But just talk to me about England and your memories of 03, because that must have been a really challenging time for you as an individual, you know, getting injured in that first game, then having to graft to get fit. Clive keeps you on because he wants you for the last pool game.
Last pool game, yeah.
Come back for the last pool game against Uruguay, so you're fit for the quarters and the semis, etc. What happened then?
Yeah, the whole thing was, the whole build-up was brilliant, you know. I think we'd all been through a pretty challenging time the few years before, kind of all missing on the Grand Slam, missing on the with the Six Nations.
Was that 2001, Grand Slam 2001?
2001, we sort of seemed to 99. Go well and then fall short on the final game. It happened year after year. 2003, we sort of managed to get it right and... It was a tough day over in Dublin, and sort of for the first time we got the Grand Slam and got it right, won the championship. So I think the boys won a bit of a high, but I think there'd been tours and we'd all been kind of learning curves for us. And you can see that whole squad get stronger and stronger. So I think when we went into the training for the World Cup, I think we had a really tight group, and it was arduous training, as I'm sure it's been for the boys this time round. But I think
I loved that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I think, you know, Dave Redding, who ran the strength conditioning, was brilliant, got everything set up for us, you know, and Clive revolutionised England rugby. And I actually don't think it's wildly different now to how he left it. The journey he took it was significant and certainly took it into the top end of professional sport. And we received all that treatment. We received all the brilliant coaches and the fantastic facilities. He moved it all forward for us. So, yeah, I agree. I loved the competition we had and boys. I mean, also, it's a fantastic group of guys as well. That we'd been through these tough tours, the Tour of Doom, 98.
That was a great one.
Yeah.
One of my personal favourites.
Yeah. I was amazed you came back from that.
I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, Rudolf disgraced himself in many ways.
Let's just say I was still a student and an amateur mindset. I hadn't quite got my head around professionalism as a 19-year-old.
Yeah, disgrace. But so come 2003, I think we had a really good group of guys who'd been through a lot together, but started to recognise how to win, started to recognise how good we were. And I think it was just a competitive group.
Yeah.
We obviously got over to Perth, and then first group game, I was on the bench, and then Ben Cohen stamped on my foot in the warm-up. And I just remember thinking, that chafes slightly. That's quite painful, that. Anyway, sort of spoke to the physios about it, and then thinking, it'll wear off, I'll be fine. And then, sat on the sidelines. Everyone else went to warm up, and I was like hobbling along, thinking, this is not going to look good. I can't actually run straight. And then I'd spoke to the Dave Redding, who was sort of putting all the bench on. I was like, probably best if I don't go on. So then I sat it out. I sat nervously for the last 15 minutes because I was the only person on the bench, and if there was any injury, anything, I'd have to run on. I thought, 15 minutes is probably... I can grit my teeth for 15 minutes.
Who was the game against?
Was it Georgia?
It was Georgia, that's right. Yeah, Georgia first game.
And then it was, you know, in the back of my mind thinking, any of those huge Georgian props can dance around me because I wouldn't be able to catch any of them.
Yeah.
And nervously got through that. And then, thankfully, we sort of... game finished and then realised I'd broken my toe, but we had enough time to recover and then you know, the big focus was obviously that I think that starting 15 was pretty established, and Jono and Benke had done a brilliant job in that. And it was about giving them a bit of a break before we went out into the knockout stages. So I needed to be fit for that final group game.
You kind of approached it like that in your head, really, did you? You didn't think that you were covering a spot for those two to be good. Did you?
My view was I was there to, you know, they were in the sort of starting positions, and my job was to kind of push them as far as I could. So by no means was it to be easy on them in training, but it was to, if the opportunity came, great. And my job was to push them and make sure I could do everything I could. But equally, I was realistic on, you know, coming that final group game. You know, John had played all the games. There was a need to give someone a break, and same with Ben. And so I think it was myself and Martin Corrie then played in the second row in that final game. Anyway, then during that, didn't feel great in my hand. And then the game finished. And then typically, everything calms down and the swelling starts. And then I realised I'd broken my hand.
How did you break it? Do you have a recollection?
Yeah.
Accidentally catch on someone's chin.
Something hard. I don't know what. So probably some massive Uruguayan head.
Inadvertently ran into your fist.
No, nothing like that. But yeah, anyway, I sort of bust my hand. And then and I sort of remember coming back to the hotel, and then Clive sitting me down saying, right, we spoke to medics. Look, this is not something we can recover from. So that was it. Time is done.
That must have been pretty tough on.
It's tough, but at the same time, you got to realize, you know, I was always a big believer. Lots of things happened that possibly looked at a bit disappointing.
Yeah,
but you can't change history. You can't change what's happened. So it was sort of disappointing at that moment. Went out with a friend and my now wife, and had a few drinks. A couple of drinks too many, probably, and then you know, that was it. And then I sort of enjoyed a bit more of Australia, watched the games, and that was me.
Did you stay out for the whole tournament? I can't remember.
I had to come back. I had to be assessed by the medical staff in Bath, so okay. I had to come back.
So you missed the medal. Do you know what? I've only just thought of it. So you missed the medal ceremony, obviously, on the pitch, despite having played in the games. You then would have missed the dinner afterwards, the World Cup dinner. You were there for everything when we got back, though, right? You were on the, because you were on the double-decker bus tour, you were there for all that jazz.
Yeah. Made the bus journey.
So, but when did you get your medal?
That was an interesting one. So I think because the group of staff we had was so big, essentially they got back and they were like, we ran out of medals. And then...
Is that World Rugby or is that England?
I don't know. Yeah. And it was one of those things that was slightly awkward. It was like, well, I wasn't actually there. I was actually out of the squad in that moment. So I was sort of quite departed from it, but it was one of the media staff. Might have been Ian Stafford.
Yeah.
I think he decided to chase it up, and the reality was I probably wouldn't have a medal now if it wasn't for him.
Really?
Yeah, because I just found it a bit awkward, and it was a bit, you know, it's a bit like sort of losing your shoes and then going back in. Has anyone seen my shoes?
But you didn't lose them. You weren't given it.
Well, yeah. So I was a bit like, right, I'll probably just leave that. And then if someone turns up with it, then great. If they don't, they don't.
Do you feel like you won a World Cup then?
I think when you're not in that 22, 23 on match day, I don't think it's quite the same feeling. But at the same time, I enjoyed that whole year. I enjoyed, you know, I was involved for 10 years and I enjoyed that whole journey. And, you know, I think it was brilliant watching the final, brilliant knowing the lads so well. And also the experiences we went through in that kind of build up to a World Cup and the warm up games, you know, and the challenges that went on when that squad got knocked down to 30, you know, there's lots of good lads who didn't get picked in the squad to start with, and I was lucky enough to get picked into that squad.
Must have been tough to watch. You said you had a wonderful 10 years with England. You had during that time, also, I mean, we touched on it briefly because of the competitor you are. You had a couple of red cards, one red card for England, one for the Lions. Why was it always against New Zealand? You seem to get a red card.
Wasn't a red card for the Lions.
Was it not? No. Oh, it was a sighting.
It was a sighting.
Milami tried to hook you.
Yeah.
How did he not get anything for that? So there's one thing that annoys me against playing against New Zealand. Like, I remember getting headbutted by Kevin Mialamu in a game at Twickenham. So I'm lying on the floor, I've just secured the ball, Kevin Mialamu grabs the back of my shirt and diving headbutts me. And in the papers afterwards, so it was, he was cited, you know, and in the papers afterwards, it was like, I can't remember who was the Kiwi coach at the time, but he came out saying, you know, this is disgusting that anyone would dare try and not discriminate, but slate Kevin Mielamu in this way. You know, he's not that sort of guy. He's like, hold on a minute, watch the video. He clearly, they do anything to get away with it. It's like, they're infallible to the law of the game at some stage. Did you feel like that? Because obviously Kevin Mielamu had his fingers in your mouth trying to fish at you. You might have accidentally engaged.
You know, it's one of those things, I think, decisions made, we've moved on. I got a ban. That was.
Do you ever reflect on any of your bans and think, oh, I wish I hadn't had quite as many. Do you ever think about the way that you played? Because you were unbelievably physical. Like, people remember you as the enforcer. I know we used that tag. I don't know what you think about that. But people remember you as that tough bloke that everyone wanted you in their team. No one wanted to be playing against you. How do you reflect on those sort of moments? What gave you that edge? And would you have done anything differently now, looking back?
You definitely kind of learn, and to be fair, the interpretation of the rules changed somewhat, and I eventually caught up. But you know, playing at Coventry, there was a time when, you know, the referees would allow players to move bodies that were lying on the ball, and I think rightly so. The rules haven't radically changed. I think it's more the interpretation from the referee are much, much tighter, and I think rightly so. It's a game we want all the kids to be playing, and I think, you know, the RFU have done brilliant stuff with the mini rugby, junior rugby, all the rule changes now, making it more appealing. And we're actually seeing the next generation of players. You know, like, you look at the group from playing in the World Cup, the skill set of Carl Sinclair and these guys. And I think it's because of the new rule changes for youth rugby. It's brilliant. And actually, it's not acceptable that players were actually getting stuck into people on the floor. But at that moment, that was...
It was legal at the time.
Well, it wasn't just illegal, but it was how it was interpreted by the referees, and they used to allow it. And actually, you know, I wanted to be a valuable part of the team to a degree that there was an element of that. My skill set was actually being good at clearing bodies away from breakdowns and actually making sure the ball was looked after, making sure the team was looked after. And I enjoyed that part of it. And as a professional player, you stretch your ability, you stretch your skill set, you get close to the edge of the rules and you're looking to test things. And, you know, in a contact sport where I think rightly so, the rules have changed now, and we're seeing the tackle rule change. And I think it's brilliant, making it a safer game. But I played within that, the width of the rules that were there. And sometimes got it wrong and got carded for it. Other times I got it right. And hopefully, I'd like to think a lot more times I got it right and was a robust physical player. I was picked to play in the Bath team. I was picked to play in the Coventry team, the Saracens team, and other representative teams. So hopefully there was more people thought I did okay and was doing the right thing.
Well, I don't think everyone thought you did very much more than okay, mate. You had an unbelievable career. And when, like I said, it was you for me, were one of those guys, you know, when you go into a team, obviously having played against you for years at Leicester, and then coming to the team at Bath, you're one of those blokes, you talked about playing for your mates and why you play the way you do. Like, you were one of those guys for me, that why you wanted to play the game and play it so physically and play it so hard, because you wanted to make sure that you were keeping up with blokes like you, who would be climbing into everyone, who would be doing anything possible to get the ball back for his team or to make the next tackle for his team. Like, I remember that you talked about detail. So I remember sitting in hotel rooms with you, me and Julian White. And we were preparing for games, making sure we'd covered off, you know, all the detail. You were probably supporting me and Whitey, to be fair, let's be honest. And we're going through line-out routines, you know, sat in that room with a load of chairs representing the other players, pretending to, just so we could remember, but make sure we went into the game fully prepared. And teammates, that's what it was about. You know, you know, you talk about, yes, you played on the edge. Yes, sometimes you went over the edge, but that's what made you so much fun to watch, play with, and be a teammate for. Do you think that of yourself? Do you think, do you know what? I was an awesome teammate. I gave absolutely everything I physically could. Yeah, sometimes I stepped over the line. Sometimes you stepped over the line on a teammate. Was it Kieran Bracken? I think there was a famous incident with Kieran Bracken where you got... carded or something.
I was carded, but it was actually cleared. A witness came forward and said it wasn't me.
Wasn't the witness Kieran? I'm sure I was reading something that said Danny Grewcock stands with former teammate Kieran Brackett or whatever, accidentally, allegedly. And I'm sure in it it said, after mitigating evidence from Kieran Brackett himself, it was like the old, you know, that old school rules where you ring up, mate, I know I accidentally stood on you, but do you mind calling up and say it wasn't me?
I think it was an independent witness came forward and cleared me. So I was actually all good.
We're going to go.
I think you're right. I enjoyed being a valuable part of the team. I wanted to be a key part of it, you know, and to be able to, you know, Johnny Wilkinson kicked drop goals and was pretty skillful and did some good stuff. And you find your niche in the team. You find your what talent, skill set you've got and what you can apply for them. And actually, I think that's the bit you want to be. You want to know that, actually, your teammates want you in the team. You want to know that you've got a job to do, and we've all got different roles, and actually making sure you try and achieve yours. And I think that's what I tried to do.
So you had an awesome tenure with Bath and England. Any particular memories from the Lions whilst we're talking about international games?
I've probably got a strong memory from the first tour in 2001, and we toured Australia. And I think we were playing the world champions at the time, Tri Nations champions.
So was that 2001?
2001
Lions tour of Australia.
And we'd, you know, arrived in Perth and then sort of circumnavigated the whole of Australia before we arrived for the first test. And I think the feeling in the group was we were kind of nervous about that. You know, we're playing against the top team in the world, and it was going to be a tough test for us. And we played in Brisbane, and it was at a cricket stadium, I think. And so the pitch was in the middle of the actual rugby pitch was in the middle of the stadium. So you weren't close to the crowd. It was a relatively small stadium on international terms, so 45,000-50,000. And I'd never encountered a Lions tour before. And you know, you go on tour with England, and you'll have a group of supporters that'll come. But you know, it's you're the away team, and I'd never encountered the amount of people that turned up to support, predominantly Welsh. The vast majority of Wales turned up for that game. It was quite unbelievable. And as we arrived in Brisbane, we were there for a week in the preparation of that first test, and just the colour of the city changed as the more red jerseys turned up. And I think the belief amongst the players, which I don't think was particularly strong at the start of the week, suddenly changed from, we have got a huge support base here. And then the energy and enthusiasm that the supporters brought us was quite significant. And I think it was possibly the best atmosphere at any game I've been at. And I remember leaving the hotel, and we came down an escalator into the foyer. And it was at a time when all the supporters just turned up at the team hotel, and they were all allowed in there, and it was just red jerseys everywhere. And I remember coming down, we almost like couldn't leave the hotel. There were so many people there. And we sort of squeezed out the hotel, got into the bus. And then the journey was kind of punctuated by pubs on the way in, and at every pub there'd been like 500 people outside all in red jerseys cheering us on. And I think it suddenly started to dawn everyone, this is going to be quite an atmosphere. These guys are here.
This is a big deal.
They've come a long way and they are desperate for us to win. And I think as we literally arrived in the stadium, I think our expectation was kind of like, oh, the crowd's going to be miles away, it's going to be full of Aussie supporters, it's not going to be that great. And we got into the stadium, and it felt like there wasn't any Aussie supporters there. And you looked around and the whole stadium was full of red jerseys, and it was an amazing atmosphere. And even though the crowd was so far away from us, they felt right on top of us. And then we had Jason Robinson and Johnny Wilkinson and Brian O'Driscoll. There's some pretty impressive players there, and Johnny captaining the team. And we pulled out a win, and it was just an unbelievable performance. And I've got a photo when we sort of, the changing rooms were underneath the stadium. So as I was sort of leaving the pitch at the end of the game, sort of a bit in shock about, wow, that's, everything went really well for us. And we sort of shocked the world champions at that time. And I'm just sort of walking down the steps, and Jason Lennon's behind me, and then the supporters are sort of looking over us. And it's just one of those kind of magical moments where you're just on cloud nine. It is just amazing. And it was brilliant as we went into the second test. The Aussies then refused to sell, and they sort of held back, say, 10,000 tickets for each of the tests. And as they released these tickets, you had to have an Aussie passport, and then they gave out you know, gold jerseys and scarves for everyone into the game to try and change the atmosphere, you know.
Because it was all red before.
And that was a huge credit to the, you know, the Lions supporters who, it felt like the best home game I've ever played in.
Yeah.
And, but we're in Brisbane, Australia. And as a series, it was actually fantastic because we were actually really closely matched. And, you know, we got the edge in the first one, they got the second one. And then it came down to the last few minutes. And I actually remember seeing Brian O'Driscoll dust, a magical player, and you just saw he can do this for us. He can do this. And he was desperately searching for that line that to try and get that final try, and we just fell short on that. But as an atmosphere, as a memory, that's incredibly strong.
And as normal, I'm running over on time, but I want to ask you two final questions. Like, if you're going to survive the cramp that you're going through on the table at the minute, you're renowned to be one of the hardest, toughest players that played the game. But for you, who was the toughest opponent? Who was the hardest bloke to play against, or the one that you maybe respected the most?
I think probably in my position, you know, you can't look further than Jono as far as someone who performed at the highest level every week. You know, he'd have played, you know, 500 competitive games with England and Leicester and the Lions. I think you'll struggle to trawl through those videos and find one bad day. And that's how good he was. He never had a bad day. But I look at the real tough guys on the field, and for me, they're the Nick Abendons of this world. They're the Kieran Brackens. They're the guys who are half the size of everyone else, but knocking them over, taking the high balls. You know, I remember Nick Abendon playing against Leicester. And the two Lange brothers.
Oh, Henry.
Oh, my God, yeah. Like, it was
awful.
Like an annual culling of Nick Abendon when, you know, they clearly, Nick is a super talented player. And one of the two Lange brothers would knock him out, essentially, just with big hits. But Nick never took a backward step. He would take it to them, you know, unbelievable footwork. But if you get that footwork wrong, you've got 120 kilos coming at you at a fair rate of knots. And he lost out a few times. But I admire the guys like that get stuck into it. And I think Kieran Bracken was a similar kind of character. You know, tough, robust, number nine. And, you know, didn't take a backward step, would take everyone on. And would knock down the big blokes. I think they're the ones you've got to be impressed with. I think it's easier if you're the biggest bloke in the field. If you're the smallest bloke, you're like, bloody hell, they're doing well.
Well, I think they'd all be delighted to have that recommendation as the toughest you've played with or against, especially as scrum halves. We'll probably never hear the end of it from Brax next time I see him. But one last question, and I try and get this out of every guest we speak to, is just something to pass on. So the best piece of advice you've ever received.
I think my dad said to me, you can learn something from every fool. And I think he was obviously talking about himself and primarily the fact that I didn't really listen to anything he said. And but I think what he meant was that actually, you know, listen is being able to listen to people is actually a key point, and everyone has that pearl of wisdom if you're willing to listen to them. And I think I look through my career, and whether it's at Barker Butts, Coventry, Saracens and Bath, I was incredibly lucky to be surrounded by very influential people, very impressive role models who did have lots of pearls of wisdom for me. And I think taking my dad's advice and being able to actually pick up little snippets from Paddy Johns, listen and watch how Francois Pienaar trained, to see what Michael Leiner did, you know, his work ethic, you know, definitely helped me become a better player by listening, watching and essentially, you know, copying what these fantastic players did. I think I look back and I think I was incredibly lucky to be surrounded by these brilliant individuals, and hopefully feel that they, you know, they did have an influence on me in a positive way.
That is probably the best answer to that question I think we've ever had. But mate, it's been a pleasure having played with you, and again, well, maybe not such a pleasure having played against you over the years. There's various different parts of my body that don't like you much anymore. But for the competitor that you were, and the fun that it was to train with you, always pushing the boundaries on the pitch and off the pitch in training. Thanks for coming in and sharing your time and your story today, mate. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, Marcus, it's been a pleasure as always. Thanks very much.
Cheers, bud. And of course, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to our podcast, to After the Whistle, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. We've got a couple of fantastic guests coming up in the next couple of weeks, so make sure you don't miss out. Also, please check the show notes and you can learn a little bit more about Switch the Play. Go to switchtheplay.com to find out the work that Leon is doing, helping transitioning players into jobs and careers beyond sport. And if you're feeling charitable, have a look at lewismoodyfoundation.com to understand what I'm doing outside of and after having played the game, supporting young families dealing with brain tumours and the much needed work that's happening there. And finally, as always, After the Whistle is produced in conjunction with Audioboom.